So we've been talking since the beginning of the year around this this term I've been calling Dharma Life Reset. It was kind of just a way to start the year off with, for myself anyway, a recommitting to some of the basics of well-being for myself, aspects of self-care, aspects of you know, starting at the foundations of tending our state. And so we started with a couple weeks talking about sleep, and then a few weeks talking about food and eating, getting into the ethics of eating, choices around food. And we just talked for a couple weeks about vegetarianism and veganism and different ways of stitching together the choices that we're making around food with our belief systems, our worldviews, our ethics, with what we think of as right view in the Dharma. When the Buddha listed out what he thought of as requisites for the monastics, these are the four things that monks and nuns need to receive in order to live. The list of the four requisites is food, clothing, shelter, and medicine. So this is, you know, this is kind of the ground level of, you know, physical caretaking, really to caretaking of the body. All of these continue to be important, continue to be unequally distributed in our culture and most cultures in the world. And every one of them is the site of conflict and contentiousness, politically, socially, economically. They all cost. Of all of them, in a certain way, fast fashion has made clothing not the same kind of requisite that it once was, when cloth was actually an expensive commodity. So, you know, even the poorest of folks in most parts of the world have access to, you know, shorts and a t-shirt. Like basic cheap clothing is everywhere. But if we think about these requisites as pointing toward, you know, basic streams of how we live in the world, we can connect in each of them to, you know, layers of ethical choices, layers of intentionality, layers of habit and trauma in how we engage with the world around us. I and many folks that I know, and many of you perhaps, I find myself privileged enough in this world to have relatively easy access to food and good food, to clothing that's, you know, comfortable and functional and all sorts of, you know, good in a lot of ways. Good shelter, which, you know, again, not everyone has, and good enough medicine, which again, not everyone has. So these are privileges to have. I think it's a profound, basic Dharma skill to recognize for any of these kinds of requisites that access to them is uneven, and to let that inform our social politics and our practice of compassion and understanding the world around us. But when I look for what's really the requisites for well-being for myself, and even just sticking to the physical, you know, those basic necessities of survival are here. But the things that I struggle with physically are often more in the realms of like staying, you know, not just alive, but healthy, staying, you know, not just, you know, functional, but like doing well. And so for myself, when I talk with students and we're looking at like, what's going on in your life? Why are things difficult? You know, how's your day to day? What's going on? Often we'll kind of work our way backwards from, you know, work is difficult, relationships are difficult. Sometimes people will start with like, you know, existential concerns about the Dharma are really hard, and we'll work our way back down and be like, actually work is stressful, actually relationship is stressful, family is stressful. And we'll get all the way down to something like, if you keep saying, yeah, but it's still just hard, like I just feel like it's difficult day to day, I'll often get down to the question of like, how's your sleep? How's your exercise? How's your food? And how are your friendships? And so what this has led me toward, and this came through, you know, a lot when I was doing trauma counseling, was that, you know, when there's a lot of distress in someone's life, a lot of things are hard, a lot of things are not going well, there can be the temptation to focus on the trauma, you know, like terrible things have happened to you and there's a lot moving energetically, emotionally, in the nervous system, it's hard to be well. But very often, you know, something that is also true when the nervous system is a mess is that these foundational systems of physical and energetic well-being often also get thrown off. And they get thrown off by stress, they get thrown off by any number of things. And so I have ended up thinking of, so food is part of the original four requisites. I've ended up adding, if I could have the hubris to do so, I've ended up adding sleep, exercise, and friendship to the requisites. So here's my seven, Sean's seven requisites, not a traditional Dharma list. Food, shelter, clothing, and medicine. And then if you've got those, good sleep, good food, good sleep, good exercise, good friendship. And so we've been, and so, you know, I just assumed, you know, clothing and shelter and medicine, at least to start the year off. And we started with sleep because in some ways for many of us, sleep, we can ignore, we can forget about, we can take for granted, we can disrupt in ways that are, you know, very painful for our well-being, but sometimes, you know, go unnoticed, and we blame our non-well-being on other things. So we started there, and then with food. And so having come just through talking about food, I want to continue in the direction of consumption and think a little bit here, and, you know, in a moment when the media is supersized in its intensity, to think about our consumption of information and that the use of our attention. Most of you already know the punchline to this whole, you know, area of investigation. So, you know, feel free to settle into thought-free concentration, you know, and rest in bliss while I talk about how to gather our attention. But, you know, the nervous system function of attention is to keep us safe by tracking and mapping the world around us. And one of the main things that attention then does is that it moves toward the information or stimulus of the greatest intensity in the field. So whatever is of the most intensity around us, our attention naturally goes there. And that's intensity, both, you know, pleasant and unpleasant, right? Because if something is life-threatening nearby, it's, you know, it behooves you for survival to pay attention to it. And if something is very pleasurable nearby, it behooves you as an animal who likes pleasure to pay attention to it. So we are drawn toward intensity. Attention follows intensity. And because of that, attention, you know, is this faculty that directs our senses to make contact with the world around us. And so when we make contact, there's a kind of relationship that's set up, right? And we talk about it in consuming kind of language You know, what kind of images are you taking in? Right? This is not because an image actually literally goes in, except that it sort of does, right? You see an image and you know how they would say, like, they would joke, if you see something particularly weird or disgusting or whatever, fill in the blank, that, you know, it's an image that you can't unsee. Memory is such that memory also is created by intensity, right? Memory isn't like a cinema verite film strip that, you know, films the boring moments along with the intense ones, right? And there was never such a thing as cinema verite anyway. They, like, the camera maker still had to choose to turn the camera on at that moment. So automatically there's choice. You know, true cinema verite is like a, you know, like a security camera outside a building on the street that's just on all the time, you know, and no one ever looks at it unless until something actually happens. My partner and I were out in San Francisco on a date sometime last year, and without our kid, and we had, like, gone to a museum and then to dinner, and we were walking around. It was nighttime. It was so blissful to walk around at night and be up late and in the city. We were walking down Mission Street near Yerba Buena in San Francisco, if you know the area, very busy area. And we had just come across this whole plaza right near the Jewish Museum and the old church that's there. And we heard this crunch from behind us. We turned around, and somebody had veered off the street, smashed into a fire hydrant, broken it off completely, and a geyser of water was shooting 30 feet in the air. And so that was super dramatic, you know. And so the person driving it, like, stepped out of the car and then, like, looked around briefly, pulled their hood over their face and cinched it, walked around to the front of the car and kind of looked, and then kind of just looked around, and then kind of glanced up, and there was a security camera right up there on the, you know, the building right next to the fire hydrant. And then kind of, like, looked away, went back in the car, grabbed something, and then just quietly, like, you know, closed the door, and then just walked off down the street, just walked away, you know, and just hoodie pulled up and just, like, quietly walked away through the crowd, and no one said anything, you know, but, you know, but there it was on camera. So, you know, you remember these moments, right? The security camera of your inner attention remembers the intense moments. You know, the definition of mindfulness we've talked about before is that it's a form of memory. And the Buddha says mindfulness is the kind of memory that allows you to remember things that were done and said a long time ago. Mindfulness in this way is a kind of attention hack that brings into conscious focus moments that are not intense, right? Usually our attention pings from intense thing to intense thing. And in between those intense things are stretches of boredom that we don't remember. You know, do I really remember what happened in between, you know, the fun lunch that I had and then the playing with the puppy? Afterward, it's like, no, it was kind of a stretch of, I don't know, I answered some emails, I went to the bathroom, I tidied something up, I don't quite remember, right? Mindfulness wasn't like tracking everything. I was relatively mindful, but, like, you know, in a, like, I'd have to really work to really remember it. And so because attention works this way, we are consuming, in a sense, anything attention lands on and stays on. And, you know, the folks who make the media that, you know, feeds us the news and feeds us entertainment and music and, you know, cat videos and Super Bowl halftime replays and whatever it wants you to, you know, the Facebook scroll and, you know, nice bits of Dharma from a teacher that you like, you know, endless things are being fed to you through your devices. And our practice has to be a kind of resistance to that because it's working on the nervous system and the attention. They know how attention works. It's created to feed us, you know, an endless supply of a certain kind of food. If you think of the information as food, it's nourishing sometimes, it's disgusting sometimes, it's fattening sometimes. I'm not going to rail against social media. You all know those arguments. But, you know, it was a conscious decision on the part of the designers of social media. The person who invented this actually has, you know, begged forgiveness of the general public. I'm not sure I'm ready to forgive him. But the person who invented the endless scroll, right? Someone actually at one point looked at websites and they were like, oh yeah, you get to the bottom of the page and you have to click a button to get another page of things to look at. And almost nobody clicks the button. And they were like, oh, well, let's just do a thing where as you start to get to the bottom, a whole bunch of new stuff just automatically loads. So you can actually just keep going forever. And that person made a lot of money for the companies that adopted that thing, which is why it's now everywhere. And they have later come on to say, wow, that really worked, that thing that I invented. And I'm sorry. I'm really sorry. You know, this is not healthy. You know, it's like, you know, speaking of San Francisco, like one of my kids' favorite places in San Francisco is the Sushi Boat restaurant, which is an extraordinary kind of restaurant. Like you sit there and little boats come floating along with sushi on them. And you can just grab sushi off the floating boats all day if you want to. And just the plates pile up and it just keeps coming. You know, the conveyor belt of really nice food just keeps showing up in front of you on cute little boats. It's an endless scroll, you know. And that's extraordinary, you know. At least with eating, you get full. And, you know, but of course, you know all the reasons, all the ways not to, and they know all the ways not to, right? They load it up with salt, so you keep being thirsty. They load it up with sugar, so you are thirsty and kind of insane. And anyway, you have to just keep eating it. Once you pop, you can't stop. It's very difficult with information to know when you're full. And so one of the things that I think we really need mindfulness and discernment for is, first of all, we were talking, you know, about eating vegetarian. We were talking about food choice. How do you choose what to eat? And to do so, we have to interrupt and find discernment around historical eating patterns, heritage eating patterns, ancestral patterns, cultural messages, things that we were taught to eat, economics, of course, because healthy food is more expensive, all of that. Take all of those same, you know, processes of inquiry and turn them to information, you know. What if, you know, and you already do, you know, you already do lots of this, right? In the same way that I avoid sugar, you know, I avoid, you know, I avoid clicking on what are called thirst traps, you know, sexy person doing something. You know, I've been doing weight training at the gym lately. And so, you know, I did some watching of like weight training videos to learn how to do various kinds of exercises. But of course, as soon as YouTube learned that I like weight training videos, it showed me a gazillion short videos of, you know, hot people wearing a little bit of clothing, lifting weights. And suddenly I have to stop myself from clicking on an endless stream of hot people lifting weights. I'm like, okay, that's not what I need. That's not teaching me anything. We have to do this, you know? Oh my God. All right. Our family myth was that those sushi boats were being rowed by invisible hobbits. I love your family. This is excellent. They are, I'm sure. Tiny little fairies on boats, you know? I got it. I like that it's hobbits, though. This is really nice. So, you know, what are the things in the information world that for you parallel like junk food? You know, what are the things that you have to actually use discipline to not consume too much of? And maybe every once in a while, you know, the way that like every few months you're like, yeah, I'm going to have some cannoli, right? Because that stuff is amazing, you know, or whatever your thing is. Every once in a while, you know, I'm going to like, you know, like we watched an entire season of Bridgerton, you know, which is essentially sugar, as far as I can tell. And I sort of felt the same way after, you know, after eating like a whole bunch of dessert, you know, we would get off of, you know, three episodes of Bridgerton and I would feel a little queasy, like re-entering the consensus world out of this like very weird made up, you know, post-racial English aristocracy comedy. It was very confusing for my psyche. I was sensitive to this very early in my life. I remember when I was a teenager maybe, and a bunch of friends were going to watch this movie, some adventure movie. And I had heard that it was a really good movie. You know, like it was a solid, wholesome enough piece of, you know, adventure. What was it? I think it was The Abyss, right? Aliens underwater, something like that, a long time ago. And I realized that I didn't want to watch it with them. And it was hard to explain to them why. And it was that actually that I didn't like my nervous system getting swept up by a fictional adventure. Like I knew what that felt like to get kind of like sucked into the story. And I don't always want that. Right? And so, you know, and of course this is true, you know, with the real world, like news right now, as all the time. The fact that you can just watch or listen to a constant stream of, you know, up to the minute news, you know, breaking news, Senator Schiff said something, breaking news, you know, Senator Green said something else, breaking news, you know, and we can think of information, you know, as a kind of consumption. And that as soon as we do, I think there's, you know, there's a practice that we can begin to take on where we just begin to tend, you know, what we take in. And you know, again, you all have heard this before, but in this moment that we're in where the news is so intense and just where the media world is so intense at all, the social media world is intense, the amount of information we have access to is so much that, you know, the discernment that we need with any kind of consumption, which is essentially like, is this healthy or not? Is it healthy? Is it timely? You know, the same way I would ask with food, is this food good, healthy for me? But also, is this the right amount for me? So even healthy food, you can eat too much of or at the wrong time, you know, for your well-being. To have all of those same questions then about, you know, the way that we consume media and to really understand that media is not, even though it's much thinner food than food, that it still is a kind of consumption. You really can't unsee things that you take in. You really can't unhear things that you take in. And the more intense, the more impact they have, right? The more intense the image, the more intense the material, the more impact it has. And that even when something is true and important, that doesn't automatically mean you need to take it in, right? You can know that there's a genocide going on and you can be, you know, clear in your heart about where you stand with that and what you believe and how you want to engage with it. And you can do that without looking at the images. You could choose not to. You could choose to say, I'm going to choose to do that. And I'm going to, in a sense, bear the consequences of doing that. I'm willing to bear that. But you could also make a choice, make a different choice in relation to it. So So I'll just end with remembering that when the Buddha described the practice of mindfulness of eating, food, the phrase in the texts is, may I get rid of, or, you know, bring to completion certain sensations without giving rise to new ones. And that's interpreted as, may I address the sensation of hunger without giving rise to the sensation of being overfull. It's traditionally interpreted as like not eating too much. And so there's the understanding that it's important to satisfy hunger, both for staying alive, but also for just being comfortable. But it's also important not to go too far. And so what would it be like if we take this guideline then, into our practice as we engage with the world of information, images, and words through the media primarily? May I dispel certain sensations, like the sensation of, you know, in a wholesome way, wanting to stay connected to what's happening, let's say, or to my people, to community, you know, or to issues that I care about, without giving rise to a new sensation, right? The sensation of having gone too far, to numbing out or getting overwhelmed, or you know, losing mindfulness and just getting lost in the infinite scroll, you know? So give rise to essentially the kind of comfort, and ease that is a kind of middle way, right? I'm not trying to starve myself, because that has unwholesome results. I'm also not losing my discernment and gorging, which has unwholesome results. Right. And then there's just a question, is this different from the fifth precept? I think so, somewhat. The fifth precept around specifically alcoholic drinks, but we broaden it to intoxicants in general, is generally around the way that intoxicants affect our ability to act ethically. And so the literal fifth precept is, you know, to abstain from alcoholic drinks or intoxicants that cause heedlessness. And so, you know, to the extent that there is a parallel here for, you know, consuming intoxicating media, which of course is it's a very useful parallel sometimes, because it can be addicting in many of the same ways. The parallel would be something like, all right, now I'm going to say it's very much connected to the fifth precept. The parallel could be something like, don't consume information that causes you to become heedless. So like, you know, not to consume, you know, how about like radicalizing, you know, information that could cause you to lose your sense of, you know, what's true or wholesome or good or who you are. You know, don't actually get red-pilled. Don't fall down the rabbit hole, right? Don't lose your heedlessness, your heedfulness in that way. All right. I actually like that. Truly, thank you. All right, yeah, we are right at our time. So we did our kind of discussion of structure before. We'll do our formal end here. And we'll just let this one rest. Next week, we'll keep going through the seven requisites and see where we need to go next. At some point soon, I'll just talk about exercise and different kinds of, we'll just think through physical activity, actually, which I think will be fun, and maybe a little lighter, not too heavy, weightlifting, pun intended, something like that. Don't know. All right. So thank you for your support of the Sangha and for the conversation that we had in the middle there. May our practice be for our own benefit and the benefit of all beings everywhere. May we be well, and may all the wars end. All right, take care, and take care with what you take in and what you put out. And we'll see you soon. So thank you so much. Hi, blessings in your practice. Thanks for watching If these resources are supportive for your meditation and your practice, liking and subscribing helps the channel. And there are links in the description below to donate to support the Sangha and my own teaching. And you're welcome to come and join the Tuesday night gathering, which is on donation and open to all. And you can find information for that on the website. So blessings in your practice. Take care.